VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello there. Welcome to Wine Times, brought to you in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. I'm Annika Rice.
And I'm Will Lyons, the Sunday Times wine columnist and vice president of the Sunday Times Wine Club. Throughout this series, we'll be sharing our love of wine and travel with a host of special guests.
From comics, actors, novelists and more, we'll be hearing about their travelling adventures, giving you a real feel for each region and, more importantly, a taste of it, thanks to Will and his stash of wine.
We're here in London Bridge, our own two-storey wine bar, tap and bottle. It has a lively, bustling atmosphere and plenty of character. The perfect spot to pour the wine and have a good time.
Well, such a well-dressed dinner party ensemble today. I mean, Will, I haven't seen you in... I've only ever seen you in one jacket the whole time we've recorded this.
Well, I thought I have to dress up for Paul.
Yeah. I mean, you do
I'm
have
so
to.
I'm so excited.
Paul Feig is best known as the creator of the hit comedy series Freaks and Geeks, as well as the director of Bridesmaid from 2011, The Heat and Spy. He's directed episodes of The Office, Parks and Recreation, Arrested Development, Mad Men, executively produced many more. He's also an author and a gin producer.
Yes.
And somehow he's found time to talk to us about wine today. We're so thrilled you've come,
Paul.
Oh, Paul.
Please. To be with you and to talk about wine. What could be better?
Thank you, Paul.
It's a double whammy,
charming,
as we say.
Can I just tell everyone how we met, because we, you know, I only met you about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. In a flamingo
night. We were at the theatre. We went to see Arlene Phillips' stunning new dance show called House of Flamenco.
Absolutely brilliant.
And Paul was sitting slightly just to my left, so I could really see him in my eye line. And you got under the skin of that dance piece.
Yeah.
Everyone else was politely loving it. I absolutely adored it, but it didn't... You were imbuing it. It was quite extraordinary.
Oh,
and kind of that made me understand the way you tick, because you just get under the skin of everything.
I'm an interactive audience member, I would dare say.
Good audience later.
Because when I make my movies, you know, we test them, which means we recruit people off the street, you know, 200, 300 people who don't know us, because that's the only way you're going to get good feedback on your movie. If people know you, you know, your family's going to go, oh, it's great. And no help whatsoever. But we also tape the audience with these kind of infrared cameras, night vision.
Yes.
So you can watch people watch a movie. And I'm always like, so many people just sit. You know, but occasionally you'll find people like kind of, and they move around. And I'm the same way, like an action, like, like this. And I'm like, oh, come on, people, like, wake up. Yes. Especially in something like that, the flamenco thing. I wanted to get up and dance.
It was trance-like watching you. As you said, it's an intense creative immersion into it. And it really did make me realize what makes you tick. And so I literally just met Paul afterwards for sort of 10 minutes and then asked him to do the podcast. And I'm so thrilled you said yes, because that whole thing of creating an atmosphere, which you've just described, is very much what you're all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you've described even the way you make films as creating a party atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. I want my movies to be fun. I always refer to my movies as like they should be parties, basically, even if, you know, they have dramatic bits and all that kind of thing, but they should be fun. You should walk out going, that was fun. We're so lucky to get to do what we do. And why, you know, there's some directors who just like create chaos on the set and scream and yell. And it's like, what's the point of that?
Yeah, no, there's something just so joyful about this man.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I discover Paul, not through your films, but through Lockdown 1. We were living in Pimlico in Dolphin Square. And you, I don't know how it came up on the screen, but you were doing Cocktail Hour.
Yeah.
And we watched every single day. I loved it. I am floored by that. And you could keep it going, didn't you? And you had a new outfit every day.
Yeah.
And you tune and you dance. And it was brilliant, Anakin. It really...
We actually based our day around it.
Well, that was kind of the goal is to give, you know, like, you know, it was March of 2020.
Yeah.
We were all, you know, I come off of a production that got shut down in North Carolina and came back to Los Angeles. And was just like, what am I going to do other than I got work I can do, but I want to try to help. And thought, well, the only thing I can really do is try to entertain people. And I had all these old cocktail books. And I was like, I always wanted to kind of teach myself how to really make good cocktails.
Yeah.
And thought, let's just do it on camera and see what happens. So the progression of the show is kind of hilarious because if you watch the first, I don't know, 20, I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't even know how to use like a lemon squeezer. So I thought you put the lemon in so it fits in the bowl. So you do it and then it sprays all over the place. But no, so you put it in upside down and turn it inside out.
Yeah. And I love the way you've made a book about it. And it's the ultimate guide to grown-up fun.
Yes, cocktail time.
Yeah.
I mean, I basically, people were saying like, oh, could you write down all the recipes from the show? Because they didn't really post them online other than the show itself. And then started writing them up. I was like, well, maybe I'll put some advice in there. And I'm very opinionated about drinking and cocktails and all that. So it just became this whole primer on how to set up your bar, how to throw a cocktail party, and what songs to play, and then funny stories.
That whole drinking thing, I read an interview you had done where you talked about Bewitched.
Oh, yeah.
And how the dad, Darren, used to come onto the set, you know, into the sitting room at the end of the day and pour himself a martini.
Yeah.
I remember that as a child. Yeah. So that was such a strong message.
Well, somehow, that to me was like what adult life was supposed to be.
Well, I thought that's what men did when they came in from the office.
Right, exactly.
My dad used to come off a building site, so it didn't quite fit. But I was entranced by this world.
Yeah, no, they always had the, you know, the cocktail cart and, you know, and he would either mix it or Samantha would mix it up for him. And I was just like, that looks great to me. You know, and that coupled with when I was a kid, very young, and my parents took me to Las Vegas when I was like 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And they went to a Muhammad Ali fight and they put me in this nursery, which was in, it looked out through this glass door onto the casino floor. And I'm in there as a kid. And I never wanted to be a kid anyway when I was little.
You didn't want to be a kid?
No, I didn't. I hated being a kid.
I can imagine you in a three-piece suit age 6.
Well, I got my first three-piece suit at age 8 and my father wanted to kill my mother because of it, because he's like, he's going to grow out of it immediately. But I did, what a great run I had.
Yeah.
But I was in that nursery looking out at this casino floor, and there's all these adults and they're wearing tuxedos and gowns and they're drinking martinis and they're smoking. And I was just like, I want that.
Anyway, we're excited to introduce 3 wines to you. Yes. We've obviously delighted that we can select America as your region.
Great.
And I think all 3 wines are inspired by classic regions of Europe.
Yeah, they
week.
Are. So, America, well, the largest wine market by volume and value. And of course, it's not just California, it's Oregon, the Willamette Valley. And now it's sort of the Finger Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
I think they will even make wine in Virginia, where Donald Trump used to have a winery, I believe.
Although
he's famously teetotal.
Yeah,
so don't mention, I shouldn't really mention that. But we're going to
Went out of business like everything else he does.
Yeah, no, he actually bought a very good vineyard, I think. Yeah, but anyway.
There you go. There's one thing you did well.
But we're in California, where 80% of all US wine is made. And I think in this country, we have this idea of California. Certainly today, as I was coming up on the train, I was listening to the birds and I was listening to Bob Dylan. I was trying to get myself into
it. He's very immersive as well.
The mamas and the papas. And we have a really romantic image of, you know, the Beach Boys. It's all
You're tasting the terrain with the music. I like it.
But actually, it's a very complex regional place. And there's lots of different styles of wine made there.
Yeah.
But we've got 3 fine wines for you, Staple. We are at the top.
I expect fine wines.
Yeah,
please.
No messing with you. You're going to turn up wearing a suit like that. We're going to turn up with some decent bottles.
So we're in the Santa Maria Valley. So we're 300 miles south of San Francisco. So I always think of a California wine centered around San Francisco, which you're completely wrong, but that's how I do geographically think of it. And we're way down, and we're in an estate called Aubon Clément, which you may have heard of, founded by the great Jim Clendenon, who sadly passed away in May 21. But Jim Clendenon was one of these pioneering winemakers who studied law but was inspired by the great wines of Burgundy in France.
Oh, nice.
But sort of had rock music playing, long hair, surfer dude, but underneath was incredibly serious about his wine. And we're starting with Pinot Noir. And I think the sort of key to understanding California wine, as you know, yeah. is the ocean. You're so near the Pacific Ocean. Yeah. And that acts as a sort of air conditioning unit. And I'm amazed when you go there how far inland the climate is influenced by the Pacific. It can be up to sort of 70, 80, 150 yeah. miles at some places. And certainly when you go north of San Francisco, you can set your watch by the fog
yeah.
that comes in.
So yeah, is that a good thing for
brilliant
wine?
Brilliant thing, because it means you get this sort of cooler climate.
Sort of sea.
And you can grow, yes, and you can grow, you can ripen your grapes so they get complexity, and you can make wines in the imitation of the great wines of France, if not better than the great wines of France.
Before this, Paul and I had a bit of an email exchange getting here, but a lot of the chat was about whether he was a sipper or a spitter. and we bonded, I felt, over the sip.
Of course. First of all, why waste a drop of wonderful wine?
Thank you, Paul.
And secondly, I think I can only fully process the taste of something if it goes down my throat, if you will. Exactly.
Of course you can. Yeah. And if we look at this now, it's sort of translucent color, but the smell.
Beautiful. Yeah.
My word.
Well, it's got a big smell.
This is one of the great wines we've ever had on this series.
Really?
I think so. Well, I love it. Yeah. It's got that sort of black cherry cranberry character.
Mm. Oh, he won't sip yet, by the way.
Oh no, I'm not sipping till he does.
But it could be 10 minutes.
In a nod to the sort of the great ethos of this estate, it's got Old Bon Clamat, and then it's got Le Bauge Odessu, which translates as wild party upstairs.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. Well, so here we are.
Here we are.
That's exactly what we have going here.
We've landed. We're going in. Right. Good luck, everyone. We're going in. Brace yourselves, strap down.
Well, that's nice. It's got a minerality to it that I didn't expect.
Good word. Yeah. No. Minerality. A sort of saline. I wrote this in the column the other day. It's got a saline character. Somebody underneath said, when are these pretentious snobs? Stop using words like that.
Minerality could be the new one. This is delicious.
We're just trying to be accurate.
And I think what you say there is absolutely right. It has like a saltiness. That's what I think about minerality.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
So all of the wines today, they combine that wonderful can-do American positivity.
Here.
But have been inspired by the classics of Europe.
Yeah,
which I love. And that marriage is just, it's dynamite.
You've just come back from Spain.
Yes.
We're just in Marbella. I'm seeing a slight suntan.
Oh, really? Oh, gosh, is it still there?
I have at
all. It's hanging on for dear life.
So is that pure pleasure, or are you working, writing?
No, I just finished my movie, finished post-production on my movie, and we usually take a vacation. We were going to go to Capri, which is our favorite place, but it's right at the end of the season. We've been there at the end of the season before, and the restaurants are kind of falling off and stuff. So my wife said, well, we should go to a health spa. She goes to these health spas. She's been to like Viva Meyer and all these places. And so I thought, oh, you know what? I kind of need it. I need to do a little detox and I could lose a few pounds. So I went and did it. And 800 calories a day.
Oh.
No booze.
Wow. Oh, no booze. I think you've gone to Spain. How
I know.
Lovely.
That was my reward after making a movie.
How did you feel? Lightheaded?
No, I actually, what they did was they have an amazing chef and they grow all their own vegetables who could somehow make these, 800 calories per day meals feel like they went a long way through shredding stuff and all that. So I actually, there's definitely time middle of the week. You're like, okay, let's have a steak.
Well, it's that lack of a glass of wine, I think, if you bothered to go to Spain, that's a bit disappointing.
Well, that's the thing. So it was all working towards, we knew we were then going to have 3 days at the Marbella Club.
Oh, hello. You missed that.
It's like fasting before the feasting.
Yeah. Although I have to tell you something very sad. My wife has turned against wine in the last number of years. It was one of the health spas she went to. They made some big speech about wine or whatever. And so now she's the wine police. So I have to do events like this, podcasts like this, so I can have wine.
Well, you can come every day, Paul.
Thank you.
And you can just, even if you're not on it, you can just sit over there on the sofa and slurp up all the empty bottles.
Exactly. It's come full circle because you remember it was the American show 60 Minutes. Mm. That said that wine was good for your health, I think, in the early 90s.
I cling to that.
And that sort of just set, that was like the touch paper for the whole of Asia, whole of Asia, but a large part of Asia as well. So it's decided drinking good wine.
This is very mixed messages, isn't it? Because I'm holding on to the message that red wine's really good for you.
My father said all things in moderation. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
I'm not into cutting something out,
I think red wine very much feels to me like one of my five a day. It's lovely.
Really? really nice.
But the point about this is, sorry to sound so dogmatic, this is a really good illustration of a wine that actually punches way above its price tag.
Yeah.
That can sit with the very best Pinot Noirs, I think, and hold its own.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's expensive, crikey, but it's not like ludicrously expensive.
What year is that?
2019.
So oh gosh, okay, yeah. So it's young.
Wow. Yeah, very young.
I had a very interesting experience. My friend Peter Harper, who was a big wine collector and one of the foremost cancer doctors in all of the UK, took me years ago to a wine futures tasting, which is the strangest thing I've ever been at because everything tastes awful. Yeah. But all these people are like, oh, yeah, I can tell. I'm just like, but I get it because I get your palate can tell what's coming.
But it takes on Premier, so you're tasting barrel samples.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the only way you can get better at that, there is a little bit of an art in it because it's a craft.
Yeah.
It's by practice. Oh, it's arduous, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like looking at a sketch as opposed to the
there's a new benchmark for your palate.
Yeah.
And virgin territory.
Yes.
And you're trying
absolutely. And what you're looking for is that dance between acidity, fruit, and if it's red wine,
tannin. Oh, is that
what
it is? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because it's also harsh. It's really
hard.
You really got to pick it out. Yeah. I mean, I felt like I was drinking chalk or something. But all these other guys are like, oh, yes. Oh, this is wonderful. I'm like, yeah, this is great. But I admire it. It's a cool skill.
Yeah.
And I like the end result.
This is Wine Times with Annika Rice.
And Will Lyons.
We'll be back with more great wine and conversations before you even get a chance to top up your glass.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
So, the second one.
So, we're up in Sonoma. This is called, do you know this estate? The Leith Estate.
Oh, I've had Leith.
Should I pass it across?
Chip Leith, yeah. Oh, yeah,
you can pour. Is this a Cabernet? Yeah. What is this? Oh, cheers.
Yeah. So, it's...
Thank you so much.
Oh, you've had a very healthy sip of the first one. Don't
enough? Tell my wife.
Yeah,
yeah, come
more.
On.
You've got, you've got a blinking...
What's the matter with you?
film launch tonight. So, how many films have you made? Just where does this stand in the sort of...
This is my ninth film, I guess. Yeah. I would say 9.5 because I made the first movie I made was something I funded for out of pocket.
I love the way that one of your first jobs was working at Universal Studios.
Yes. I was
and
a tour
you
guide.
Just thought, this is a world I want to
be it was
part of.
Heaven to me.
Just like that.
Well, a kid from Detroit, you know, when you live, when you're in the Midwest, especially back then, I mean, the internet now, I think everybody's more savvy, but like movies just, and showbiz were like something on another planet.
But who inspired you growing up in the Midwest? Watching these films.
I wanted to be an actor first, so I started out loving comedy. So Steve Martin was a huge influence on me, and Groucho Marx was a huge, and all the silent comedians and Laurel and Hardy and all that. That was a big thing, and Monty Python and all that. But then the movie that cracked me open was I went to opening day very first showing at the Man Chinese Theater of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I figured out what a movie director does. Because I'd always watch movies like an actor, like, oh, I want to be in that movie or whatever. And this is the first time I like saw an audience go crazy. I was like, oh, that's what you can do to an audience with a camera.
But even when you're acting, were you all the time aware that you were actually hanging out with the cameraman and looking?
Oh, yeah. I was always on the side. Yeah, yeah. I didn't hang out with the actors as much as I hung out with the director and the writers and the camera guys.
So it was there. It was just sort of being unleashed. It was your fault because you've just got too many skills. So you diverted your life by being such a successful actor.
Well, thank you.
So then you had to swap again.
Well, the other problem when you're an actor, you know, I have such sympathy for actors and they're my favorite part of the process, but it's a hard job. It's easy to make fun of actors and like, oh, this. And stand around. No, it's really hard because if somebody doesn't like what I do, they go, oh, your directing's off or we don't like your writing or whatever. It's okay, fine. If you don't like an actor, you don't like them. Like if you get turned down for a role, it's like they just didn't like me, you know? And I've learned over the years, it wasn't they didn't like me. I just wasn't what they envisioned for the role.
Yeah. Right. I'm confused now. This is the darker one, isn't it?
So we've got up to Sonoma. This was founded by a chap called Chitleith, who was a son of a Colorado banker, but fell in love with not Burgundy as our first one, but Bordeaux in France.
Ah.
So came to California, wanted to create a sort of Bordeaux-inspired blend. So all Bordeaux wines are blends. Mm. And this is a blend of predominantly Merlot, Malbec, Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, and Cabernet Sauvignon. So it would be a right bank Bordeaux. So this would be the equivalent of, say, a Pomerol or a Santa Maria.
So many blends.
Yes, and it's perfect because, like having a cast of actors, the weather in Bordeaux and Sonoma is not always even. So if you think about wine, you are relying, unlike gin, you have to grow the grapes first.
Yeah.
You are in the hands of the weather gods. And if it's a really hot year, one grape variety could do really well. If it's a really cold year, another grape variety could do well. And so it's almost like the ingredients, and they're adding that sort of salt and pepper.
Yeah.
And so all of those grape varieties will have a slightly different flavor profile and will add something else to it.
Okay.
Well, let's go. Sorry.
It is the dark. I'm now confused. Oh, but it's that one on the right, isn't it?
Yes, it's the one on the right. The winemaker now is Katie Carter, but it's deeper.
Paul loves
but it has.
Already.
Yeah, well, first thing that hits me is vanilla.
Yeah, exactly. But it's got that oaky character, but it's also. Oh, yeah.
It is very vanilla-y, isn't it?
Let's have a sip, actually.
Oh, God, Will is having a sip. That means he really likes this bottle.
Oh, I like this. Yeah. This is a home run.
That's a lovely raspberry character. It's almost like raspberry compote, isn't
it?
And succulent and rich.
Oh, that's
It's a big wine. But
it's
a big wine.
It's, it's 14.5%.
That is roaring log fire, isn't it?
Yeah.
On Christmas Eve.
But Paul, Annika's been going on about, these wines all serious. And I think this might be the wine you like the most.
This is my favorite.
Because it's
I really prefer red wines, to be honest.
Well, and I'm a Bordeaux fanatic. My favorite Bordeaux is Margaux.
Oh, God, this is
Margaux fanatic. Yeah, I love Margaux.
I'd expect nothing less. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm very happy with that. Thank you. Well, but I'm really very happy with both of those.
I know, exactly.
I passed the test.
Yeah, really, very much so.
I'm a guy who doesn't get to drink wine normally, so I'm finishing these glasses.
No, because you can go home and you can say to your wife, honestly, I did have to drink today. Mm-hmm. I know, in theory,
I'm
post-spa and body ready for something else, but
Annika made me drink.
Annika just insisted. So, wine number three.
Well, our third wine is one of the most famous wines in the US.
We're off north again.
We're in Ridge.
Right.
I'm presuming that Paul probably has this in his collection.
I know this one very well.
And it's an interesting story, isn't it? So it was started in the late 50s by a handful of scientists from Stanford who bought a property overlooking what is now Silicon Valley. Mm. And there were some old vines in the garden. And being scientists and of that intellectual bent, they thought, well, we'll make some wine and see how it is. And they'd only bought the property for the views. And they took it quite seriously. I think the story is they even got lion dung from San Francisco Zoo to keep off the deer. So they're obviously quite meticulous of what
they
were doing.
There's a lot of dung they must have needed. There's probably only a couple of lions in that zoo.
Exactly.
Driving up. And what they didn't realize was these vines had been there. So the thing about America, of course, it had prohibition. And actually, they didn't rip up a lot of the vines. They just let them lie dormant. Mm. So these vines are very old, and they're some of the oldest in the world, pre-phylloxera. It made glorious Cabernet Sauvignon. Mm.
So they were just lying dormant or sort of unpruned and untethered.
Yeah,
and
during
wild.
Prohibition. Yeah. And then they would have been, then you had Second World War, and then they would have come on. So they would have, but the thing is, the roots every year would have been going deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
And for a vine, you want it to be old, because when it's young, it just grows like a weed. And the fruit, there's so much fruit. But what you want is a lot less fruit that's really intense. Yeah. And that's why as it gets older, 40, 50, 60 years, it reaches its prime.
Yeah.
But further north, up where we are in Sonoma, in sort of Redwood country, they bought a vineyard up there called Geyserville, and they started making, Geyserville.
Geyserville, is it Geyserville?
No, it's
Geyserville.
Geyserville. Yeah, I live in Geyserville.
And it's a blend predominantly of Zinfandel, which is the grape of California.
Oh, so this was decanted. Why is this decanted and not the others?
Yeah, means the price ahead. Tag has gone up a couple of £100, do you think? Is that fair to say?
Well, I popped in last March to see the winemaker, John Olney, and he put on a very nice, like they always do in California.
Oh, of course.
The welcome in California, we have to say this, is it can only be rivaled by Italy. Such a warm welcome. And everyone looks so healthy there as well. But he recommended decanting all his wines. And this, again, it's very, very young. So this is a 2021. Wow. This will age and improve in the bottle up to 30, 40 years.
Wow. I'm smelling peach in there, am I?
And I think Zinfandel can get a bad name. But actually, when it's really good.
Yeah.
This is one of the great wines of the world.
Well, White Zin pulls all the other Zins down.
It's a very cheap.
It smells sawdusty or...
That's the aged American oaks. They've got American oak, but it's already had wine in the barrel. So it's that.
I can smell the barrel.
It's like oak meets citrusy
it's
fruit.
It's like, I know this sounds a bit pretentious, but it's like dry cocoa
literally
powder.
Literally never anything you could say is pretentious.
Dry cocoa powder, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, if I was writing for the Sunday Times about this wine, I just like to keep it really simple. Is it red fruit? Is it dark fruit?
Yeah.
Well, the first two were red. I think this is dark fruit.
Okay.
Every time I smell this, it smells different, though.
Yeah.
I'm picking up something completely different. Because I just picked up on the cocoa, but I smelled peach the first time, and then I'm smelling the oak. And
I was making notes this morning. Like I always do, diligently for this.
Yeah.
And one thing Paul Draper said, because he was never trained, but he said, if you think about the great wines of the world, they always have that mystery and that element of surprise because they always change in the glass, exactly like you were saying.
I can't be held back.
Oh, wow.
That is... Wow, I'm left speechless by this one. I'm not a huge Zinfandel fan, I have to admit, but this is spectacular.
And what's interesting is it smells really rich and succulent, but actually it's quite light, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite feather light on the palate.
Well, that's my problem with Zins is they usually smell thin and they are thin.
Yeah.
But this is...
I'm sorry, this has now become my favorite. I'm sorry.
Oh, this is...
You can't change it now.
I think John Olney would be very pleased, yeah.
Cheers.
Do. Yeah,
cheers.
You have to hold
Paul,
it right at the bottom of the stem.
Oh, for the cheers?
For the noise.
Oh, there we go. Very nice.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Great I stem. Love that you've described a comedy as trying to capture lightning in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Have we captured lightning in a bottle of wine for you?
There are
today?
Three bottles of storm clouds here filled with lightning. Yeah, it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
And do you know, on the subject of lightning in a bottle, when you're creating comedy, or even when you're performing yourself, but obviously more as a director, you hug yourself and think, that's the lightning it's got in the bottle, put the lid on quickly.
Well, you do, but then 9 times out of 10, it doesn't end up being the line that you end up using. That's what's so interesting about it. And that's why I do so many test screenings, because what I think is great, sometimes an audience does, and a lot of times they don't. And then the one I think, oh, that's so stupid, or that's weird, that's the one that destroys.
But often on the set floor, is there a sort of frisson when you just
I've
really
had a couple
landed.
Of jokes in movies where I just went like, yes, like when we would build it naturally and like, add this, and you're like, oh my gosh. And like, the actor just hits it so perfectly.
It is extraordinary because you have launched the careers of so many actors that you really could add agent practically to your list.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very lucky. I work with great people, but I have a great casting director who brings in amazing people for me to see. Allison Jones, who's basically the mother of modern American comedy. You have a conception of who you want, but then if somebody comes in that you don't know and you're like, wow, I didn't expect that. And that's not what I was looking for, but that's better. That's exciting. That's really exciting.
And with something like Bridesmaids, when you had Kristen Wiig's best friend, Maya Rudolph, coming in, you just thought, well, let's just get the best friends in because we know that chemistry is there.
Even audition Maya because we wanted that relationship between them so that you didn't have to have this speech of like, oh, well, you know, I'm Annie, sure I've known you for 20 other. Years and blah, blah, blah. You know, you just see them together and they're having fun and they're so tight that that it's, you know, it just comes across.
So
how come you spend a lot of time over here in London?
I made my last three, well, my last two, I made the movie last Christmas and The School for Good and Evil, shot both in the UK.
Yeah.
And then the new one, Jackpot, we shot in Atlanta, but we posted it here because I was supposed to be shooting my next movie, the sequel to Simple Favor, the movie I did in Italy starting in October, but the strikes pushed it all off. So,
because I was going to come back?
We're going to shoot that in the spring. Yeah.
And you've really embraced London life. You know, I follow you on social. You know, you love St. James's Street.
And all the Dukes. My wife and I met 33 years ago over our love of London. And we were big Anglophiles. My mom's side of the family is British. I just got my ILR, so I'm official. I took the test.
What were the questions? Because Kathy was saying she had to give you sort of cribs or.
Kathy said, "Oh, it's really easy." She goes, "They just ask you like, is it legal to murder people?" It's like, and then I got in there. It was the hardest questions I've ever had in my life. I studied for a week at least. This, you know, give me this guy.
All right, give us an example.
Oh, I mean, you'll all know it, I'm sure. But like, who invented the jet engine? You know, which is whittle.
You have to do that.
Yeah, what percentage of people who live in the UK have parents that were born outside of the UK? And it's like, but it's like 10%, 15%, 20%. It's like,
is it multiple choice?
Yes. But still, it's the kind of thing. Yeah. There's things you study and you say, I need to know this. And other things you go like, well, that's a list of names. I guess I don't really need to know those things or those numbers. I don't need to know. And then it's all those. So I thought for sure I had flunked and I was so angry. And then they came through insane. That I must have just squeaked by.
Wow.
So congratulations, UK. You've got, I'm a stupid American.
Welcome to Britain.
Thank you.
Well, I'm very excited. We're about to sample Paul's gin.
You couldn't think of a more British spirit, really.
That's why I just wondered whether that was that a British based enterprise?
Well,
or was that
no,
a,
it's actually
American?
Out of the UK. It's a American made gin, but it's a London dry.
Yeah,
it's made in Monroe, Wisconsin.
Well, I think Paul should serve this and prepare.
Yes,
can I just say I'm very excited about this because I love gin.
What a beautiful bottle! Yeah. Almost like an art deco. It's like a wine decanter in itself.
Yeah, well, we were trying to figure out what to do with the bottle. My business partner and I, and it's just like, and he was the one that said like, well, what about a decanter? I was like, that's a brilliant idea.
That's a very good idea because after use for a bottle, is lovely.
But we're actually going to start doing refill bags. So you can refill it and not have to, you know, there's a lot of glass here.
The heaviness. Goodness. That
if you
want
to play a game
of
Cluedo, that's Professor Mustard with the gin bottle. So you know I'm British now because I said Cluedo and not Clue.
Very good. That was very good. You're completely fully immersed. You've done your immersive thing once again.
There we go.
And why was it gin that you went for? Why not tequila or vodka?
Well, the road to it was, again, my love of adult life and seeing the adults drinking martinis. When I got old enough to be able to drink, I immediately said, I want to have a martini. I had a gin martini and I was like, oh, I don't know. I didn't like gin because I had a bad experience as a kid, which a lot of people did. You go down to somebody's parents' basement, tastes like cleanser or something because you're a kid. So I was kind of like, oh, I guess I don't like gin. So I started drinking vodka martinis. But then I was reading all these books about cocktails and they always said a real martini is a gin martini.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, then I have to like gin. So just basically said, I'm going to teach myself to like gin.
That's heroic of you.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly. I give for my art. But I actually, it was when I was, I mean, God, in my late 20s, and my wife and I came to London for the first time. We went to the Savoy.
Yes.
And I went up to the bar and said, like, can I have a martini? And they served it in this thistle glass, and it was frozen. It was ice cold, and it was a gin martini, and it was fantastic. And I go, oh, because I guess I've been drinking, like, lukewarm gin or whatever.
Yeah.
And that it became an obsession with gin, and I've gone all over the world, tried a million different gins. always looking for the perfect one. Always found ones I like, but I was like, if I can make my own, I know exactly what I want it to taste like. And it's this, Ardingstalls is the name of it. That's my mother's maiden name. And I say, well, Ardingstalls, what? but I think maybe that's good. Like you have to have something memorable. Once
so I often drink gin on the rocks.
Yeah,
I like it neat. Nice. I mean, I love gin, yes. Will. Yeah. You don't even understand. I find putting tonic in a gin is nice, it's but heresy. It then tastes of tonic.
It is heresy. That's why I do gin and soda. I'm on a national crusade.
Thank you.
Pyrrhic crusade to try to get Brits to drink gin
and soda. I'd even cut out the soda.
Yeah, if you want to.
Well, then it's a martini.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But you have to have a little bit of vermouth in a martini.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because a lot of people go like, oh, just wave the bottles. No, you got to. It has to be in there. It's like having a good single malt. You have to put a drop of water.
I'm very excited about this.
Well, here we go. Right, I'm going to open it up. Here we go.
Wait. So are you going to actually swallow?
Well, I'm going to smell to begin.
Cheers. There we go, guys.
Spring light citrusy is.
Yeah. That's the first thing I wanted to hit you with.
Oh, my God. That's lovely.
It smells of early summer, does it? Early spring.
Oh, my goodness. That really has got a...
I will say we've won a lot of awards.
A sense of spring. Got
like a 98 from a food and drink magazine. And
Oh, I'm very happy.
I once went to a gin school for the day.
Oh,
and the tutor,
of course you did.
And the tutor drank every gin.
Yeah, of course.
And he gave a lecture that he said, and they're quite large measures. And, you know, wine, you'd always spit.
Oh, no. Well, I've never been drunker in my life. The day I had to finalize the recipe for this.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you know how, I'll give you a very quick lesson in how you make gin, you develop a new gin. You go in to the distillers and you go, these are the gins I like, these are the gins I don't like, here's the flavor profiles I want. You do this for like hours. They say, okay, they go away and they'll make 8 different varieties that are all in the world what you're talking about, but very different. Bring those back, you know, like a month later, you go through them all like, no, that one not good. I like this, something in this I like, something. They take that, go back, and then make 8 more varieties that are closer. And you just do that like 5 or 6 times until it's down to micro varieties, absolute micro varieties. And that was the last day we did it was, well, it was the second from the last. I found one and I was like, I think this is it, but there's something off. It's something's a little not right. And my business partner, who was drunk at the time. Yeah, he was drunk. Yeah. He's in the spirits business, so he knows stuff more than I do about how to develop it. He said, I'm telling you, I think it's just the alcohol content. If you're drinking right now, it's a 44%. If we make this 42%, it's going to be perfect. I said, I don't think that's it. He said, trust me. He was completely right. When I had the 42, it was perfect.
Oh, this is just I have to say, I like through it. My veins.
Yeah, it's my kind of gin as well. You know, God.
Will and I have got to go and do some interviews after this.
Well, then down really the hatch, my friends.
Cheers, Paul.
Cheers.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks for bringing this in.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for enjoying it.
Lightning in a bottle. Let's raise a glass to lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, cheers. Cheers, everybody. Thank you. This is amazing.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, that's it from us today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Wine Times in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. The series producer is Anya Pierce, the producer Callum McRae, and the assistant producer has been Shana Johnson.
You can follow the podcast so you never miss an episode. Just do this via your favourite podcast app.
We'll be back next week with more delicious wines and another great guest.
And remember that all of the wines we tasted today are noted in the episode description, and you can get your hands on all of them from the Sunday Times Wine Club website.
But from all of us here at the Tap and Bottle, thank you very much for listening. We hope to see you next week for more Wine Times.